Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now all the way up to episode number 558. My name is Camden Busey. I'm pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm back with a friend of ours, very pleased to welcome back to the program, Dan Ragusa. Dan is a PhD student at Westminster Theological Seminary out in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, although he's in Long Island today. Welcome back, Dan. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be here. I appreciate your Long Island accent.
It's not much of an accent. The only reason I joke about that, because I was told one time by somebody from Long Island that G matters. So.
And the O. Well, the O is big. Long Island.
I can understand. Yeah. Well, it's great to have you with us, and I just got the update from you, but to let everyone know you're still working on a PhD at Westminster, but you've now finished the coursework and you're kind of gearing up hopefully sometime soon, I guess, to start thinking about comprehensive exams. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm supposed to talk with Dr. Tipton next week about the comprehensive exam, so get some more info on that.
That's great. Yeah. For anybody who cares, the PhD, at least in the American, or sometimes it's called like the British system, but what we have in most PhD programs, and this isn't just for theology, but it's for most PhD programs in any field in the United States, you begin, and for many you have entrance exams, not just for admittance, but sometimes after you've been admitted, you might take an exam, and then they'll find out if you have any areas that you need to get up to speed on. So you might have some remedial work to do even before you start the regular coursework. But then you have your courses, and that often for a lot of people takes about 3 years. What is it, like 36 hours or something? You have 12 classes and each one's
12 courses.
They just call it by course numbers. But if you think of it in terms of credit hours, it ends up being about 36 because each one's about 3 hours. Two of those at Westminster are externals. Where did you do your externals?
So I did one at Villanova, which is pretty close by.
Nice.
I think we mentioned that one of the last podcast here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the other one I did at Puritan Theological Seminary.
Oh, great.
I think they just started their PhD program there with Dr. Adrian Neely.
Yeah, I just met him.
Yeah, and actually what we're going to be discussing today came out of the course that I took there.
Oh, good. I was wondering where this came from. I'm excited about it, and that's a wonderful paper to write there. I mean, yeah, this is right up their alley, so this that's really good. You're able to do that. After the coursework, typically, well, you also have two languages, modern languages. A lot of people do, German, French, or Latin, or Dutch, or something like that.
Yep.
And then you end up with, after that, you do comprehensive exams, which you have to know pretty much everything about everything, not just in your field, specific field, but in your field committee. So for you, I take it that would be systematics, apologetics, and church history, right?
Yeah, yep, those three.
And then you have a focus. So is yours in ST? Or
yeah.
So then you have a major exam in systematics, so it's the hardest and the most thorough and in depth. But then you'll have minor exams in church history and apologetics. Of course, you know all this. I'm just saying for the people that might be interested in this. And then after you pass the written exams, then you have to go in and do oral exams, where you sit down with the faculty and you have to kind of tell them, they did grill you about everything. They kind of ask you more detailed questions about the stuff you got wrong in the written part.
Right.
And then they'll start really firing at you from all angles. And if you happen to do well there, then and only then are you even considered a candidate for the PhD. So you ought to be 3, 4, 5 years in, however long it took you. So most people study for those comps for like a full year at least.
Yeah.
And then you're a candidate. But up until then, you're just a student. So that in the American system, that matters. Candidates versus students. If you're a candidate, it means, oh, you've made some good progress.
Big deal.
You've done a lot of work here. Sometimes in the comps, some guys, they might want you to kind of improve your knowledge on a couple things. So sometimes you might get assigned a paper or two. But after all that, you finish the comprehensive exams, both written and oral. Then you can start working on the dissertation. So... Mm. You got any ideas of what you might want to do if not looking too far ahead, but it'll come up sooner than later. Have you already started researching or working on some ideas?
Sort of.
Yeah.
I'm kind of narrowing some stuff down. Been thinking regarding some stuff with Herman Bovink. I had actually had an article published in the Mid-America Journal on what I called Bovink's Organic Apologetic.
Really good.
So maybe developing some of that and some of the lectures that he gave at Princeton, the Stone Lectures.
Yeah.
But I haven't really narrowed it down more than that.
Well, whatever you do there, I think it'd be wonderful. And I think you're the right person to do it, to continue in much of that work. Perhaps if you get into that field, you make a trip or two overseas, we could connect you, if you haven't already, to James Eglinton and some of his ilk, like our friend Grace Utanto and other people that have studied with him. But there's kind of a, I'd like to say renaissance, but it's not really a renaissance, but in the sense that, and it's certainly not necessarily a retrieval or recovery, but we're doing like new things in Bovink studies, and it's a very exciting time.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I'm glad you published that in the Mars Journal. And people need to subscribe to that. A lot of our listeners, I'm sure, subscribe to the Westminster Theological Journal. I've been a subscriber since 2003, and have read quite a bit of. I always appreciate getting those articles, but the Mars Journal as well has a lot of good stuff in there. If anyone cares to know, I mean, Dan, you and I now have more of a Mars connection because I taught you an anthropology class. Well, I should say this.
Yeah,
I was the professor of record for anthropology. I don't know how much I taught you, but anyway.
Oh, it's
only 20. But you're a student in there. But now I not to toot my own horn, but just in case people wonder, I got elected to the Mars board. So
hey,
now I'm a board member. I got to go for my orientation next month. So I love.
Did you just find that out, or was that?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. Because the Mars does an interesting thing with the board elections. They make nominations and they have certain criteria for this. So they had a gentleman, John Hilblank, who's a well known pastor in the OPC, a very godly man. Love him dearly. He's my parents' pastor. He was serving on the board, but he's can no longer serve because of term limits. And so they're not required by constitution, but the way they typically like to do it with the board is they like to spread their board members out across the denominations that they typically serve. So a lot of Nay Park denominations and then other denominations that are, if they can. I mean, they also serve a lot of folks in New Zealand with the RCNZ. I don't know if any of those brothers are on the board. It'd be awful difficult.
Right.
But regardless, they have they're very conscious of their ecclesiastical connections and who they're serving. They're explicitly serving the church and trying to train men for gospel ministry. And so they kind of had a need for a Midwest OPC guy. And I kind of fit the bill as me and my friend John Hartley. What they do is it's kind of like a tournament. And so it's for checks and balances, and it's all wise and good, but they typically will have two nominees for each spot. And then ballots go out to the Mid-America Association, who is comprised. No, our alumni are. Well, thank you. Thank you. I'll pay you later in whatever goodwill. But or Bitcoin. So or Dash, whatever it is. Bitcoin Cash, I think I have. Are alumni part of the association too? I assume that might work.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, there's an association composed of supporters and people that subscribe to the standards that Mid-America subscribes to, three forms of unity, Westminster standards, stuff like that. And so I like the way it's done, and Mid-America is structured in a good way. It's a very good school. It's a smaller school, but they're very focused on what they do. And I think they do it really well. And so you're an example of that, Dan, being a good graduate and going off to other things. But also it's just a testament to the way that Mid-America trains the men for the ministry because of how much you guys get around the country and doing pulpit supply and stuff. You don't have as much opportunity for you in the URCNA to do that in the Philadelphia area. But my goodness, when you were a student, where were people going? I think people would be surprised just to know how far the Mid-America students travel to do pulpit supply.
Yeah.
While they're in class.
Right. Yeah, they would intentionally give us off on Mondays so we could travel to various churches on Sunday. So, I mean, some would just go to Michigan. Like, I would often drive a couple hours to Michigan every Sunday to preach there and come back that night. But a lot would go to even up to Canada, out to California. Internships-wise, I mean, all over the country, out east, Long Island, Manhattan. I mean, they're going all over, really.
Yeah, I know. And it's not just the Reform guys, too, but the Presbyterians. I know we've had Ryan Noah's gone up to Canada and other people. And it's not unusual for us. You know, when I was in Westminster, I did a lot of pulpit supply. I sought it out on my own and also being encouraged by my local church. But this is something that's done really well, and it's institutionally encouraged at Mid-America. And I mean, they even have things like just little attention to detail and encouraging men to be considerate of and thoughtful towards serving as pastors. Mm-hmm. Because they, I mean, I was surprised when I went there. I was sitting in the lobby just waiting for somebody to get out of a meeting because I was going to go get lunch. I noticed that there was a binder that had sample bulletins from all the churches that guys had ever gone and done pulpit supply at. So they even ask you for your ministerial apprenticeship program and your other involvement with the practical theology department to bring back bulletins.
Right.
So if guys are going to preach somewhere, they'll pull a sample bulletin out. They'll familiarize themselves with the order of worship. And little things like that really demonstrate a deep concern for what we're doing here in terms of the ministry.
Yeah, and then they would also, whenever you went out, it would go through the school. So then usually Mark Vanderhart there would even send evaluation forms out to the churches, which they would then distribute, and then they would send back to the school. So then you have some accountability, and then also just helping you work on certain things, which is really, really helpful.
So I've got to see that from your vantage point, not having done it myself, but from speaking with students. I've also seen it in some regard from a adjunct faculty perspective, seeing how things are done. But I think the most encouraging thing for me is to have seen how the MAP program, the Ministerial Apprenticeship Program, works from the perspective of a pastor who is pastoring current students.
Right.
And that, to me, is the most encouraging because of how much they involve me and our church, our session, in the lives of the students, not just, you know, asking us to fill a form once in a while, but having us come down, interviewing us, discussing with us, speaking with us about issues with the students, vice versa, having us provide input to the faculty about how best to care for the student while they're being educated. So it truly is a comprehensive kind of life forming thing. And, and to see the seminary that is not, you know, an arm of any denomination, being, it truly is a parachurch organization, but it's one that in no way is a quasi church. Neither is it purely just an academic institution or like a degree mill, but is deeply involved in the day-to-day life and the ministerial formation of the students in the classroom, between classes, and even at home outside the classes. So, I can't say enough about Mid-America on that point, so I guess I'll be able to say more and have an obligation to say more, I guess, as a board member.
Board now. So,
anyway, but we're very happy that you're at Westminster to get back to the point at hand. So excited that you were applying there and that you're in the PhD program doing fine work with fine people. And so I wanted to speak today with you about Petros van Maastricht. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about a paper that Dan wrote through Puritan, but as part of the PhD program at Westminster. We'll get into that in a minute. But I do have a couple things to mention if we haven't taken enough time already. But very quickly, I want people to get out onto the website, reformedforum.org, for two reasons. One, you can register for the conference coming up October 5th through 7th, 2018, here in Grays Lake, Illinois. The early bird rate is now, the early bird time for registration is now over, but you can still register for the main conference for $65. $40 student rate, I believe, is still in effect. That might have been the early bird student rate, but people can check My wife will tell me after she listens to this. I don't even think she does listen, but she's in charge of that. And so you can register and come to the conference. We're really excited about what we're doing. It got some big surprises coming up. Some new scholarship on Voss and some other stuff. All as part of a big bundle where we're trying to deal with what we believe is a very important theological topic. Dan, have you been keeping up with this? I'm wondering to get your perspective, because I've been outside of the Westminster bubble for 6 years plus. This theological issue, just talking about the effects of Thomas Aquinas on the one hand and theological mutualism and others, and then seeing the new scholarship we're seeing with Voss and the Reformed dogmatics and this rediscovery and this emphasis again on the deeper Protestant conception. This stuff isn't just optional stuff. This is really at the heart of a lot of what's going on, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the influence of Aquinas, but yeah, and Bard as well. And then just pinpointing it, which I really appreciated Dr. Tipton doing, just pinpointing it at that image of God issue.
Yeah.
And how that just begins to illumine really this systematic, you know, presuppositions and everything else that's undergirding these systems. I was even just reading, this is not related to the paper we're going to talk about later, but I was reading Bovink recently and on the image of God. A lot of similar things to what Voss is saying, maybe not as pointed at times, because Bovink tends to be a bit more comprehensive in dealing with other issues. But very much noticing the Neoplatonic influence, which he noticed like four or five times in that section, of the Roman Catholic view of the image and also the vision of God, and seeing God, the beatific vision. So yeah, definitely, and him himself saying how that reveals these deeper structures and sort of the nature grace dualism that you're going to find throughout Roman Catholic thinking as well, on a whole. So definitely important issues that really get at systematic, you know, systemic problems and issues that are taking place. Yeah.
No, I appreciate that, and you know, we're hopefully trying to focus a conversation on really the core issue we think is at hand in so many dogmatics discussions today. So we'll see if we succeed, but it's looking good. I mean, I'm very encouraged, I should say, by the conversations I've been having with my colleagues and their addresses as they shape up, as we discuss these issues and toss some things out to one another and sharpen the points. I really trust going to be a very well, you know, attended, but also a well worthwhile event to come to. So if you're interested in that, you can visit us online for that. Also, I know I've been talking about it and promising the registration is soon. I am waiting on a piece of paperwork, but I have everything lined up pretty and ready for this Wimberley conference coming up in April, April 1st through 6th. And so Dr. Tipton is going to be teaching a seminar on the foundations of covenant theology. So there's a lot of biblical theology there. We're looking at focusing in on protology, which is that time leading from creation leading up to the fall into sin, and all of the covenantal foundations of that era. So you're definitely, people are going to want to come, and this is an adult Sunday school level material. Now, anyone knows, if you want to go deeper, you can interact with us and speak about all of the intricacies of this, you know, covenantal thought. But it shouldn't scare anybody away. So we're hoping that a lot of people will come. And it's a great opportunity for men to bring their wives or wives to bring their husbands, whoever's the main listener of Christ the Center or Reform Forum stuff, you'll enjoy it. And we've got a tremendous venue. I'm so excited about this place called the Old Glory Ranch. And it's a beautiful place. We'll have pictures and everything available on registration. I'm hoping in a couple days I can have that registration up. Like I said, I'm waiting on a piece of paper, a contract that we would just feel most comfortable having that in hand before opening up the registration. But the week-long registration for the event is going to be there. But if you want to also spend a lot more time with the Reform Forum people and speak about theology and hash ideas out around the fire pit or around the barbecue, having a glass of wine, whatever, we're going to have this little area with six guest houses. One of them will be occupied by our speakers, and well, Lane's the speaker, but and by our other colleagues. But then we'll have five other guest houses that, if you would like, you can rent and reserve the whole guest house for the week. And if you just want to reserve one for you and your wife, that's fine. If you want to pack in four dudes into one of the places where you can have up to four, that's fine too. We're just we're reserving them unit by unit, and then you can divvy up with your friends or spouse, however you want to handle it. And so that's going to be, I don't even know. I'm very excited about it. I know it's going to be awesome, but I don't have a whole lot of words to describe it, because this is going to be our first go around. So it's going to be a week-long event. And there's plenty to do outside of the event if you want to come down. It's a wonderful area for weekend getaways and you name it. So it's not just all theology all the time. You can go and do a bunch of tourist stuff or just enjoy the Texas Hill Country with your wife. But if you want to do all theology all the time, you could do that too, because that's what we'll be doing, and come and visit. So that's going to be on the website as well. All right, enough promotion, Dan. Let's get back to business. We're going to talk Petros van Maastricht. His name's been popping up quite a bit online. People might not know. Well, first we'll talk about biography, but I want to introduce at least a new book from Reformation Heritage Books, Theoretical Practical Theology, Volume 1, Prolegomena, by Petros van Maastricht. It's online at Reformation Heritage Books right now. Hardcover's going for $38, list price $50. So that's out, and that's big news, isn't it? Why is that such a big deal?
Oh, for many reasons. I mean, just his context. I mean, you have the van Maastricht himself being part of the Not Already Formati. So you have this reform movement within the Netherlands. So it's a very much distinct Dutch thing. But then you can begin to trace later developments with van Maastricht further. I mean, to even some of our favorite theologians coming out of the Netherlands, of Bavinck and Voss, and then even in Van Til, though more so being in the Voss as well, being more in the American context, but certainly having a sort of influence there. So moving from the Reformation to that post-Reformation period within the Netherlands, again often referred to as the Nadere Reformati. And then moving that even forward. So it brings about a lot of continuity, I think, between a lot of the more recent neo-Calvinistic thinking from Bavinck and then even from the Reformation period as well.
Mm-hmm. Who was van Maastricht? I mean, can we talk a bit about his dates and background as we're introduced to him? And really, why don't we know much more about him? What's been the history of understanding and scholarship on this guy?
Yeah, so he was born 17th century, I believe 1630, out in the Netherlands. And he studied at the University of Utrecht, which is where Vutius had been professor there. And so he studied under Vutius. And after Vutius either passed, I don't know if he passed or he just left or he retired. But then van Maastricht ended up becoming the professor of theology, of practical theology, actually, at the University of Utrecht. And what's very fascinating about him, even just during that time period, is that you have the beginnings of the Enlightenment, the early Enlightenment period, and especially the Netherlands context, in which you have men like Descartes actually moving to Amsterdam in the Netherlands, where they had a bit more freedom to speak about their new ideas and stuff. And so we end up having is with van Maastricht and even in before him with Vutius, you have these initial responses to the Enlightenment from a reform perspective, which is also what kind of drew me to consider van Maastricht. So a lot of studies on Vutius have been done with his correspondence with Descartes. So they actually wrote to each other. And so you can find a lot of research on that. But then moving a step further to van Maastricht, not a lot has been written, written about him. With his polemics and his responses to the new philosophy that's taking place in the Netherlands and really throughout Europe. Van Maastricht in that sense is pretty important. he wrote in Latin, and so a lot of his stuff has not been translated, which is one of the reasons why there hasn't been a huge amount of studies done on him. But there's been a few, Adrian Neely being one of them, who had written really, I think, one of the only like comprehensive studies or a book that's dedicated solely to Van Maastricht in English. So, but with, as you mentioned, the translation and publication of his Theoretico Practica, his theoretical practical theology, hopefully that's going to lead to a lot more studies and developments in Van Maastricht. Again, as that.
Yeah, we hope. I mean, we saw that, I think it was 03, that the first volume of Bavinck's Dogmatics was released in English. And it took several years, but that really sparked such a revolution in Bavinck studies in the English language. And it just makes it so much more accessible. You know, we hope that, you know, original scholars are reading primary sources in the original language. But even just to get a general familiarity with somebody or to be introduced to somebody, it's so helpful to have it in the language that you're most conversant in. And for a lot of theologians, definitely everyone here in the U.S., that's English. And our Latin skills are fairly non-existent. And we just don't have that as a lingua franca, you know, or a lingua whatever, theologica anymore. And so if it's not in English, it's just doesn't exist for so many people, which is which is unfortunate or regrettable. But we're praying, I'm hoping that these new translations will spark interest and people will dive down more deeply into his studies. Van Maastricht is an interesting guy, and he wrote some polemical works, didn't he? What was some of the biggest issues he was most concerned about in his time, but what really did he devote his writing efforts to addressing?
I mean, there are various issues going on within the church, even within the Dutch Republic and the specifically Dutch Reformed Church at that time, with certain separatist movements like the Lobbyists. You can read about them, quote, these holiness movements, which he wrote against. But more on an academic level, he specifically again addressed a lot of the new philosophy that began to sort of encroach into Reformed thinking. It's coming into the church. So the one of his, you know, pieces that I looked at was his polemic against this guy, Balthasar Becker, who is actually a Dutch Reformed pastor. He was in Friesland for a time, and then he had moved to, came into a lot of conflict there, and moved to some of the rural churches out away from sort of the center of things. But then he eventually goes back to Amsterdam, and he's has this whole program of utilizing Cartesian philosophy as well as Spinoza's philosophy as well, in order to sort of, what he says, disenchant the world. In his view, this sort of pagan notions of supernaturalism, angels, Satan, all that stuff sort of crept into the church, even in the early church, and then how that got developed over the over time, and really exponentially worsened under the medieval church. And then how the Reformation didn't do a good enough job in sort of disenchanting, removing all of the supernatural elements from Christianity. So anyway, so this new philosophy, that's sort of one manifestation of it, a major one as well, just because Becker's position within the church. And then his work that he had written, which was called, if I remember, get the Dutch, he wrote it in Dutch, it ended up getting translated elsewhere. But his Betovorde Werelde, which is like The World Bewitched, major work, four-volume work. And that becomes, again, just gets translated and gets internationally well-known. I think there's even, you can find articles that are that study the spread of that work. And so Van Maastricht takes Becker up, specifically in one of his polemics, with this, again, the influence of the new philosophy coming in.
Yeah, we definitely want to say, I think Becker was getting at something important and trying to address superstition and these pagan notions. So we'd say, yeah, we want to address those too.
Right.
But it seems, from your article and the reporting here on this and dealing with the issue, that Van Maastricht wasn't in favor of the bewitched world, but had some deep questions about how Becker was theologizing. What was his method, and what ultimately were his goals? And it seems as if I'm not mistaken, that Van Maastricht's major treatises, he wrote treatises against Wittig, Allinger, and Becker, they're all dealing with this Cartesian philosophy. And that has to do a lot also with our epistemology, you know, foundationalism and things relative to that. What did Van Maastricht, what was he most concerned to protect, namely with the doctrine of Scripture and how we approach it as our principium cognoscendi? Why was that such, what were the stakes? I'll put it that way. What were the stakes in his interaction with Becker?
So yeah, on the surface, you have that issue of the supernatural and the natural, and how do they relate to one another? But as you've been getting at, Van Maastricht penetrated beneath that to the method being used, and specifically the relationship between Scripture and philosophy, in which he saw this new philosophy in the Cartesianism that begins to come into the church. What he begins to see is Scripture being subordinated to philosophy. So that Scripture is then sifted through the philosophical presuppositions and the dualism of Descartes and even the dualism or the pantheism of Spinoza as well, in which you have sort of thought and extension or body and spirit, but no way of bringing them together. And so in a lot of ways, what Van Maastricht notes with Becker, as well as others like Kuhlmann, Jacobus Kuhlmann, and others who are in the Dutch Republic, what they begin to notice is that Becker moves them towards skepticism. So you have this divide, and so Becker's not necessarily denying the supernatural, but he's denying any type of interaction between the supernatural and the natural world, the interaction between thought and extension, or between body and spirit, which again begins to undermine, in Van Maastricht's thought, it begins to undermine the authority of Scripture, in which Scripture clearly teaches there's an interaction between the two. Becker will basically look at the Scriptures, talking about Satan, for example, in Job, or Satan tempting Eve as a serpent, and the various manifestations of Satan and the supernatural, the demons and devils throughout Scripture, he'll just write them off as, you know, purely figurative. They're symbolic, but there really was no interaction between the two. And so Becker, he begins to really undermine the basic reform principle, which, I mean, and it continues even today, right? They're just developing and understanding the proper relationship between philosophy and theology. Again, Becker subordinating Scripture to philosophy. Meanwhile, the Reformed and Van Maastricht are seeking to use philosophy as sort of a handmaiden of theology. There was a great quote, if I could just look it up, I should come to it pretty quickly here. From Adrian Gudrian, Asa Gudrian, who had written a fine work looking at some of these philosophical issues, called Reformed Orthodoxy and Philosophy, where he looks at Boethius, Van Maastricht, and this guy Driessen. And he was making this point in which they showing how these Dutch theologians viewed philosophy really as a handmaiden for their theology. And then he makes his conclusion saying that the theological development from Boethius to Driessen supports the broader claim that biblical Christianity outlives the philosophical and conceptual apparatus with whose help it is explained, which is to show how, I mean, they utilize certain philosophies, but they were always used as servants of Scripture, so that as you know, Scripture is always going to continue, those truths are going to continue, even if the philosophy is thrown away or done away with.
Yeah, that's really good. And it goes even deeper for Van Maastricht. It's not merely some abstract commitment to Scripture, but it he also was concerned for piety. And right. the issue at hand, it seems, was also not just merely a matter of methodological fidelity, mm-hmm. but a matter of covenantal fidelity. And who, right. are, and namely, who are you worshiping? Right. Just to read, you know, I thought this was a very succinct and wonderful portion in the in your paper, but you say, in other words, Maastricht's polemic against Becker included the fact that by not beginning with Scripture, his theology did not and could not end with worship. Mm-hmm. Thus, it was not merely a matter of whose principium was correct, but who worshiped the one true God in spirit and truth. You know, and that's really mm-hmm. the crux of it. The theological method is not the ultimate goal. It's not our telos. Mm-hmm. We're not just worshiping a method, but our theological method needs to reflect faithfulness to our covenantal Lord so that we would be led into all truth. And right. but and so he understood those connections. It's largely why you know, we're concerned about what we are with a conference coming up in the fall.
Right. Like, I was thinking the same thing.
We love so much about Thomas Aquinas, but you know, again, we're gonna be poking a bear here, but there are some very deep differences in theological method between the Reformed mm-hmm. and between Thomas.
Right.
And so we want people to be aware of those things. And Van Maastricht was very much aware of those with Becker, even though we might find a formal similarity. They might be mm-hmm. companions or friends on an issue formally, you know, right. against superstition, against paganism. But he realized, well, look, I can't, you know, when we dig in any deeper, this is not an ally of mine, because there's a deeper question. The question is whether or not he's actually following after the Lord,
right?
In a way faithful to his word.
Yeah. Yeah. Van Maastricht, he'll in his Prolegomena, so the volume that was just published, he will define theology as the doctrine of living to God through Christ. So William Ames had defined theology as the doctrine of living to God. And so you can read a book by Jan van Vliet called The Rise of Reformed System, where he looks at Ames's influence, even in Van Maastricht. So he does deal a little bit with Van Maastricht. But you see that the idea of theology as the doctrine of living to God. So there's the practical, true religion influence. But it's always through Christ. So it's always mediated through Christ as well, which he moves beyond Ames in that regard. And it's interesting because that very same concern you see throughout Voss's writings. I mean, you know, why does he want to maintain the image of God as he says, you know, the that which disposes us for communion and fellowship with God? I mean, you begin with man's origin, nature. Those beginning things have influence on the ending, the ultimate telos, the goal of worshiping in true religion. Which you see in Van Maastricht, and I'd be very interested, which I haven't done, to see the influence possibly of Van Maastricht and this whole period upon Voss's thinking, because he is quoted throughout his Reformed dogmatics. I looked it up briefly this morning, where Van Maastricht cited four of the five volumes of his Reformed dogmatics, except I think in the soteriology volume. But I mean, clearly Voss had read Van Maastricht, and he has a similar concern for true religion.
Well, on that point, it's interesting, I think, and worth me asking you. There's this regrettable divide that people often make between the scholastic method and mm-hmm. you know, piety or the Reformation, and so, you know, for many, many years, people just assumed the scholasticism is the arch enemy, and that if we wanted to be following after the Bible, then we got to get rid of scholasticism or the schoolmen. The scholastic method of eventually, you know, at some point in time, that word scholastic got linked up with individual figures, mm-hmm. you know, like Thomas Aquinas or other Roman Catholics. But it was really through the great work of and the continuing work of Richard Muller and many scholars who have now followed after him that recovered right. And opened up the doors for us and reintroduced the Reformed tradition to, you know, a proper and a very biblical and wonderful world of Protestant scholastics seeking right. to do Reformed Orthodox work. Van Til, you know, in the way that he wrote, you know, very different than I hope he would have written on the other side of Mueller on this particular issue. So he's just anti-scholastic. But you see a guy like Voss, Van Til was his hero. I mean, he was the, you know, loved him, and him and John DeWard would follow Voss around the campus at Princeton. And he was absolutely devoted to Voss. So Van Til is not opposed to the Protestant scholastics, but Voss, we see very clearly in his Reformed Dogmatics, is interacting with all of these people very deeply. We also see elements and you know, the forms of scholasticism in the way he did his dogmatics. So all of that is to lead up to me to say, what was Van Maastricht's views on this in terms of the scholastic method? Surely he wasn't opposed to it, but he saw that it could also be used as a tool that could lead someone into greater piety and deeper piety and greater fidelity, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned before, I mean, he even defined theology as the doctrine of living to God through Christ.
But that's not anti-scholastic.
No. Right. I mean, and so, and so the way he even, and this is something that Adrian Neely, Dr. Neely, has observed and has written on. So if you get his book on Van Maastricht, you'll get more of this. But he notes with Van Maastricht and with others as well that there was this fourfold approach to doing theology at the time. You began with scripture. You then formulated your doctrine. You then moved to the polemics, defensive and more on the offensive. And then it culminated with praxis of practical theology, worship. And so that method organized in that way is a bit scholastic, and it's moving towards that practical point, and which is very interesting because I never noticed that before until I took that course out at Puritan with Dr. Neely, and it got me thinking about Herman Bovink's theology as well. If you know, like, because I always notice as you're reading, you know, through the chapters that Bovink writes, they always tend to culminate on this very like doxological note of like of worship and something very practical and I always wonder if that was on purpose or what he was doing. But then you begin actually noticing this larger structure within Bovink's own thinking of moving from scripture. So they're exegeting scripture as foundational to what they're going to go on to say. Then they formulate doctrine. Then they do the polemical aspect of it, and then it culminates in this worship. And so the scholastic method isn't opposed to that. It actually, I think, for Van Maastricht and others, served that end. And as another side note, if you read Bovink's Philosophy of Revelation in the first lecture, he makes mention specifically of those four methods of components or aspects of theology. But then he actually adds a fifth to it, which is very interesting. He's talking about the philosophy of revelation as being a sort of fifth one that is grounded in scripture. And so very interesting to kind of develop that some more. But yeah, I mean, this fourfold approach to theology was evident in Van Maastricht and others in that Reformed scholastic period, especially within the Dutch context. And again, you see that continue through. Bringing out the practical goals of these things. Yeah.
So what was going on in the Netherlands in you know, early 17th century and mid 17th century? Could you speak a bit about René Descartes and his influence on the Netherlands? Why was this such an issue where Van Maastricht really spent three of his major, if not his only, I don't know his full bibliography, but at least three major polemics against Cartesians?
Yeah. Yeah, so I mentioned before, Descartes was having issues with his ideas being accepted or not back in his home Paris, and so he ends up moving to the Netherlands in 1628, and so it's very much just in their context, and his philosophy begins to really to penetrate, and this would be a long study in and of itself, the relationship between Descartes' own philosophy and then the later Cartesianism, which you can. Said a study, I think it's written here, where this guy, Thomas Arthur McHagan, had written a book called Cartesianism in the Netherlands, which I believe it's actually a dissertation, from 1639 to 1676. So you do have a lot of manifestations of Cartesianism, and it really took root there, and so it begins to penetrate into the churches.
Yeah, the Reformed context, too. I mean, people should know it's not just Protestantism in general or or, you know, Catholics or anything like that. It really got in the mix there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, so then, and so guys like Becker, who we mentioned before, who want to sort of, especially Becker, he wanted to appear as sort of cutting edge in the academy. And so they're taking this
error number one.
Yeah. Right.
if you get that, all the more power to you. But if that's and what you're shooting for, you're done. Yeah. I mean, it's a perpetual error.
Yes. So wanting to appear as cutting edge in the academic world, was his downfall. It really was in a lot of ways, because then all of a sudden these new thoughts are coming that seem very sophisticated and all this other stuff. And so he ends up latching on to these, Becker and others. And then it begins to, again, lead to these issues on the surface, again, supernatural versus the natural. But again, the methodological issue at bottom, and then the practical goal that it's ultimately missing begins to come in. So you have Descartes and his philosophy, which, I mean, again, a basic rationalism, I think, therefore I am, beginning with his own autonomous mind, which I don't believe Descartes necessarily even rejected the existence of God, but it became skeptical of it, and there really was no connection. It ends up leading to this dualism.
Yeah, it's interesting that Bavinck would put that emphasis on the philosophy of revelation. This is very anti-Cartesian. You know, what's the indubitable for Descartes? What's the most foundational thing that you can stand upon as a thinker? And, you know, what's your foundation? Well, it's the fact that I'm thinking. And even if I doubt that I exist, it's still me doubting.
Right.
And therefore I am. Mm-hmm. Rather than understanding that we're based upon the triune God of Scripture who reveals himself. It's a completely different form of epistemology, different from revelational epistemology. So
that's really
a root there.
Yeah. And when you don't begin with Scripture, you end up having either a type of monism where everything is just one.
That's right.
So everything is just diversity, pure diversity, but there's no ultimate unity. Unless some type of monism will promote or propose some type of unifying factor within the world. But that ends up just destroying the diversity, because it ends up abstracting everything to basically to nothing. But on the other hand, with Descartes, you also have a dualism of spirit and body, in which they can never be brought together. Scripture brings them together because the mind of God holds them together.
Right.
But rationally, man's mind cannot bridge that gap between spirit and body. And really can't even understand himself, which is very, very interesting, other than leading him to being a purely material, mechanical being, or at least leads to skepticism regarding the spiritual.
Mm-hmm. So what does he do with that? I mean, what's the advantage for Becker to follow after Descartes? And then it just is convenient because he can quarantine the superstitious problems away from, what's really important about a man.
Right. Exactly. I mean, so one scholar, Jonathan Israel, is a pretty good book, big book on the Enlightenment, had mentioned how you have these movements of skepticism, again trying to sort of, because there definitely was some abuse of magic and superstition and all this other stuff that needed to be addressed, as we've mentioned. But really, you know, you have what Israel observes, like Becker, along with like Hobbes and various others, who are really seeking to disenchant the world, as Becker says, you know, to sort of get rid of the entirety of the supernatural. There is no Satan. There is no demons involved in anything. There's no devil. And so for him, it seems to lead to more sanity in thinking. But again, as we mentioned before, there's the desire to answer a problem that he sees. But again, those deeper personal motivations of just not wanting to submit himself to Scripture, because it doesn't look intellectually advanced or something to be impressive.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, in a lot of ways for him. And so then, but yet he wants to, because he's in the church context, he doesn't necessarily throw out scripture, which is very interesting as well. Like, he'll even, in a sense, use reformed categories and topics and terms, but underneath them is scripture being subordinated to this rationalistic philosophy.
Wow. We've got to be careful not to draw too many parallels with the contemporary world, but there seems to be so many points of contact between a figure like Becker, what makes him tick, and the things that he's trying to do with so many of the present day, and especially, you know, in the Presbyterian context, also the Roman Catholic, but especially in the Presbyterian context in the early 20th century with the liberals. Because you find, you know, this usage of scriptural categories and scriptural language, but, you know, vacating them or evacuating them of any scriptural content. And right. So you end up with people who don't dig down any deeper to find out what the meaning is. Or with the issues of Barth. He sounds very reformed. But when you dig deeper, you see that there's something else going on underneath. Do you find similarities there, or are they more than formal similarities, you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely those similarities and the parallels there, and you see that throughout church history in so many ways. Compromise thinking isn't always obvious. Usually, you have to dig deeper into which makes methodology so important. And also considering, you know, the starting point and also the ending points, because the middle may sound very good, but often if the beginning is off and the ending is off, then ultimately the middle is going to maybe look good on a formal level, but it, in essence, is going to be saying something totally different than which ultimately you want. So yeah, I mean, and that's the parallels here are actually what sort of motivated even this study, because as I began looking at this topic, yeah, you do see these parallels, and so which is what made me very curious about this, again, this early response to Enlightenment thinking and how it's sort of just continued and been recapitulated in other contexts even up to the present.
Do you think something like this would fly today in a postmodern context? Is there any way that you know, we might see some sort of rehashing of Becker, or have we already?
In a lot of ways, you see the, so for Becker, it was the divide between the supernatural and the natural. Today, even earlier with the development of liberal theology and their view of history, and so all of a sudden you sort of concede history to the world. Just take the natural world, can take the history, and then, you know, we'll posit this, you know, Geschichte, or we'll posit some realm in which all that we need is taking place, but it's divided. It's not, there's really
like
not
Kant,
a...
Kant saved faith. Thanks, Kant.
Yeah, right? So, in a lot of ways, that Kantian dualism or the divide... even really a dialectic is present even up to the present, and you see that influencing the theology. So the Enlightenment in its core principles of human autonomy, they've always been trying to penetrate theology and to take the scriptures and subordinate them to themselves, but it's been the Reformed's task to continue to hold the scriptures up as authoritative and to utilize philosophy as servants and handmaidens, and being willing to get rid of it when it's not helpful.
Mm. So I'm looking at the article again, and I should let people know Dan posted this on reformedforum.org, but we've since gone and typeset it. So I hope to have, by the time this episode is posted, a PDF, a very nicely laid out PDF of this article for people to download and read it themselves, interact with it, hopefully get in touch with you, Dan, about some of the ideas. But one thing you have at the end, not only throughout, you have documentation, as any good scholarly work should, with footnotes, but at the end you have a helpful bibliography of all the works that you've consulted and interacted with. Where would you suggest people to go to read more, to follow up with this? What kind of plan of attack would you provide you know, not just reading them alphabetically, but where do you start? And then after the first one, where would you go from there?
So, I mean, at this point now that Van Maastricht himself is published, you can at least look at his Prolegomena, in which he's dealing with some of these methodological issues. The first book I would probably suggest is Dr. Neely's book.
I'm just going to put that on my list. Except it's from Brill, so I suspect I might have to save up for 6 months.
Yeah, you may need to take a loan out before buying it, or if you have a library nearby to get it. I believe, actually, I was on the Heritage Books website with Puritan's bookstore.
Yeah.
You can actually get a pretty cheap copy of, what's the book called? See if I can find it here. Oh, The Art of Living to God, which was, I believe, his original PhD thesis.
Yeah, it looks like he has a PhD in the bibliography you put at Utrecht. 2005. So it's relatively recent.
Yeah, so he looks wrote good. That. And I believe that the volume
$25.
Yeah, I was going to say, the volume published by Brill is either a reprint or an updated revised version. So in substance, they're going to be about the same. I mean, there might be some developments or revisions in the Brill volume. But that the Art of Living to God is more affordable for $25.
So, you know, not to do any puns here, but that's substantially the same, but possibly $300 cheaper.
Possibly. Yeah. Just saying,
get the Brill from the library if you can.
The revisions might be worth another $500, $600.
It depends who you are, right? Right.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a scholar, read the latest. If you're somebody like me, who's not a Van Maastricht scholar or a scholar of Protestant scholasticism, but is very interested in it and it will help me and inform me in my studies, then I could probably get by.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So I would definitely start there to begin exploring Van Maastricht. I'm not sure if a biography is coming out on him.
Ooh, that would be nice.
It would be nice. Yeah. I for some reason I thought I heard, but I think I'm confusing with somebody else who's a biography is coming out on. But yeah, I would go there. And then the Asa Gudrian book as well, but that's also Brill. So it's going to be expensive, but the Reformed Orthodoxy and Philosophy will get at a lot of these issues as well. The relationship that the Reformed had towards philosophy during that time.
Well, I'm hoping that these new publications and new translations, we love Brill. Brill publishes excellent studies.
Yeah.
And that's world-class work. But they often tend to publish things that are hyper-focused and narrow for a scholarly audience, which is what the economics of it make the price the way they are. That's just how things work economically. But with this increase in focus and attention on Van Maastricht, I hope and I pray that there will be a lot more interest, and then you'll start to find very good quality works, you know, in the $25 range, because more people are interested, more people will buy them. They don't have to make back the publication money on 15 sales, you know. Seriously, I mean, you know, I don't know what the numbers are for Brill, but I can't imagine they're much more than a few hundred,
right?
You know, so it's just how things work. You know, and you're going to find great Bovink studies, but you know, Brill's not the only one publishing Bovink studies. That's because there's more interest, but that interest was driven by English translations.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully more, I don't want to say popular level, but more accessible works would start to be made available. Which is also one of the reasons I wanted to write that thing on him as well. It's just trying to get something out there.
Well, that's why we wanted to talk to you about it as well, because, you know, we can introduce Van Maastricht to more people, and hopefully more people will get interested, study him, write about him. I'm sure that there are many prime opportunities, not only for dissertations on Van Maastricht, but a lot of THM theses. I've been a big advocate for the THM program, especially at Westminster, because they have the modular program now. There are many people out there that I'd like to recruit. I think you need to come in and get into the THM program. You don't even have to move.
Ryan Noah being one, right?
Yeah.
It's why
I encouraged him to do it, and I'm glad that he decided to pursue that. There's so many topics and things that need to be studied, and the THM program is a great place to do that.
Absolutely.
And that also can get flipped over to the PhD. If you get in the program and you realize, I really like this, I want to go further, then you're taking the same exact classes. Not that they're a different section, they're literally the same class as the PhD class. So it's a great way to get in and test the waters. Well, you got anything else, Dan? I mean, this is just whetting the appetite for me.
Yeah.
But I don't want to leave the people hanging too much. You know, do you find, just to put a cap on it, is most encouraging to you about Van Maastricht and these developments?
Yeah. Because one of the things is, well, two things. I mean, and things we've been talking about, maybe just to summarize the points, is the simplicity of his approach to philosophy, in the sense of just maintaining the basic reform principle of the authority of Scripture as they engage the world and its thinking, and the willingness to do that in Van Maastricht was crucial for his own time period as he engaged in new philosophy, and it remains crucial even today for us. So there's a lot to learn from Van Maastricht here. And then secondly, the ultimate goal of our theology and our polemics and all that we're writing to ultimately be the true religion, fellowship with God. And so maintaining that as our aim and our ultimate desire, why we want to be accurate, why we want to engage these thoughts, why we want to be very, in a sense, militant against certain thoughts, because it has to do with worship and it has to do with God himself and knowing him and enjoying him forever. So I think those two, you know, the beginning of his thinking and the ending of his thinking are just so crucial for his own time period. And again, even today. And then learning to fill that out with future scholarship in between that, and how, you know, specific doctrines and specific doctrines other than just what we've been talking about here with the doctrine of Satan. And, you know, why is that important? For him, well, you know, again, once you begin to separate those, actually, maybe I can just note a few of those points that he made.
Yeah.
You know, why is this doctrine so important? You know, that he says in the, one of the final sections of that work that we've been talking about, again, the polemic against Becker, is how the doctrine of the devil is, what he says, efficacious to the worship of God that is true piety. And he gives a few reasons why. He says, because it emphasizes or illustrates the majesty and glory of God, as it sets up a diametrical contrast of him with Satan, who is opposed to every good thing. This doctrine also explains the misery of those who are under the power of the devil, and therefore, again, by contrast, the joy of those who have come under the reign and rule of Christ. This doctrine further warns that the convocation of sin is demonic, which keeps people from indulging themselves. It also incites God's people to shrink back from the image of Satan and to desire conformity to the image of Christ and fellowship with the Son of God. It forbids fellowship with all evil and sin and makes God's people strong and resilient through trials and temptations. And finally, it provides comfort from the assaults of the devil against God's people and his church, since they know that Satan is under the power and knowledge of God and must serve his ultimate purposes. So even this one specific doctrine, again, is serving that higher end of true piety, of true religion. And so, again, beginning to explore Van Maastricht and seeing how these other doctrines throughout the whole theological system are going to serve that end as well, and why we need to formulate those doctrines beginning with Scripture and not subordinating Scripture at any point to some type of alien philosophy.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely important. I appreciate that, exposing that to us. But for people that would like to follow up, you can see here I've got a printout of the article.
Cool. I haven't even seen that.
Yeah, cool. I know. I'll send you a copy after I export it here. Beginning with Scripture, Ending with Worship, An Analysis of Petrus Van Maastricht's Polemic Against Balthazar Becker, written by our guest today, Daniel Ragusa. Dan, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
You know, people can find all the information here online at reformedforum.org. And the episode will be up there with a PDF of the article for you to download and read in whatever way you'd like. And you can get a hold of us by sending us a note at reformed, mail at reformedforum.org. You can tweet us at reformedforum. On this article, if you want to get in touch with Dan, it's probably the best way, just fire up a comment, get in the comment thread, and we'll interact on the ideas. But I hope we have a bunch of budding interest in Van Maastricht. It's an important thing, important person to study. I want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.